Hello, my fans, friends. Welcome to the Rich Herring podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Thanks to everyone who's come to see the Can I Have My Ball Back tour so far. It's been going really well. I've got a 4-star review in The Standard, 4-star review in The Telegraph, who once called me the worst comedy experience of the year, so that's a turnaround. People have been coming, people have really been enjoying it, and it's getting better and better. The only gigs this week are both in Pocklington, the town I was born in, near York. There's a couple of tickets left for the evening show and a few more tickets left for the matinee, I think about 4:30. But love to see you there, Yorkshire. Pop along. Check richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs to see if I'm coming near to you. There are tickets left for nearly every show in the tour. I think Norwich has sold out. And a couple of gigs in London could do with your support as well. Anyway, please listen to the podcast. Do spread the news about the podcast to your friends. Listen as much as you can. Numbers are slightly down, which may affect the future of this podcast. So just leave it playing, even if you're not in the room. Love you. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy whatever it is you're going to listen to.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Welcome to another Hollister Book Club. This week is the fantastic, probably the best book we've ever had on. It's called Can I Have My Ball Back? It's by Richard Herring. And to interview me about that is the wonderful Adam Buxton.
Now, I'm taking control of this conversation.
Yeah.
I'm turning the tables on you, Richard Herring, in your own parlour, in your own book club, because you are the author. I've got a lot of good questions. I've interviewed many authors on my podcast.
Yes, you have.
Ian McEwan the other day.
Yeah.
And now I am talking to Richard Herring, which is much better. And
no pressure.
I've got some good questions.
Okay.
And I even Googled good questions to ask authors.
Okay, good. I'll send me the document because I need that for when I'm interviewing next week's guest.
Yeah, I was hoping there were going to be a load of stupid questions that I could take the piss off. But the first place I found was a website called BookFox, run by an American author called John Matthew Fox, a young guy. And he helps authors to write better fiction and has lots of tips for writing on his website. I recommend it. And the questions he sets out, 50 questions to ask authors that aren't the usual. Where do you get your ideas? What's your writing process like? What advice do you have for writers, etc.?
Yeah.
His questions are very good.
Okay.
So I might pepper the conversation with a few of them.
Good.
But I will start by, well, I started my conversation with Ian McEwan by asking about his reviews.
Yeah.
Because I'm always interested / obsessed with that kind of thing. People's opinions of you, their judgments of what you do. And I've heard you talking a little bit about that kind of thing. I heard you talking to Richard Iowade about it the other day.
Yeah.
How do you deal with all that? Are you aware of it? Do you seek out people's responses and reviews?
Yeah, I do. I like to see everything. And I very, very rarely get upset about this. Weirdly, sometimes something will trigger something off in me and I feel the need to defend myself, but it's often just something really off the point, so I can sort of take getting negative stuff. I think being a stand-up comedian as well, you're so used to that being a possibility and delighting in it a little bit when people don't like you. I really think for most online, you know, if it's a newspaper review or even an Amazon review,
if it gets promoted to the top. Like, with the problem with men, there's a sort of internet troll who hates my International Men's Day thing, and he's got his one star review promoted to the top. He'll be delighted to hear that slightly annoys me, but partly because he's misrepresenting shelter and all sorts of things. Not shelter, refuge and everything in it, I think, from memory. But mainly it's kind of interesting. I suppose if you get like a big newspaper review, at the moment as well, it sort of feels like you don't get much press coverage for a book. Or certainly I don't get much press coverage for a book. So I think if you are aware you're doing something that a lot of people are liking and you get one review and it's, yeah, this is pretty... Like when I did You Can Choose Your Friends on ITV, it got very nice previews, and then the review in the Evening Standard called it the worst thing that's ever been on television, basically. Which just seems so extreme. And it was sort of a charming family sitcom, and I couldn't work out what had upset him so much to go that far. And that was upsetting because I was hoping to do a series of that. And I think getting like a being called the worst program that's ever been on television isn't very hard.
Did they actually use that phrase?
It was more or less that. It was so bad. And I could, you know, and Rebecca Front had said to me, this is one of the sweetest, most charming scripts I've ever been in. And I love it. You know, we had an amazing cast. And just for some reason, a few people took against it. I think because I was in it and I was playing a guy who had a younger girlfriend who was, and they were having lots of sex. Not that we saw very much of that. I think people just thought, oh, you know, he's done that so he can kiss an actress and blah, blah. So I think there was sort of resentment to me a little bit. I don't know. But yeah, so that it's weird when you think it might affect the future of the project. That's the worrying thing about it. But, you know, I sort of like it, and I like to get feedback, and there are reviewers that I would listen to. You know, I don't think I'm a perfect, fantastic writer. So it's, you know, if there's, or actor or anything. So I think if there's constructive criticism, but I quite like seeing this. I quite like seeing on, I go with Twitter, I name search on Twitter and find out the really horrible things that people are saying. And sometimes I chip in on those and say, yeah. Someone on the radio version of that sitcom, I did an episode that was an entirely a Zoom call, which I was aware was not going to be a groundbreaking thing, but equally I wanted to make it kind of realistic to the time. And someone did a Jackie Weaver joke, and someone went, "Oh, someone's still doing a Jackie Weaver joke in 2022." And I go, "Well, A, I wrote this quite a long time ago. But B, you're not meant to be thinking it's a great joke. It's just the sort of thing that happened at the time."
Critics dealt with. Congratulations on the book.
Oh, thank you.
I would, if I was leaving a thing to go on the front of the book, which I try and avoid whenever possible,
yeah,
I would use the phrase bollockbuster. Is that, I mean, you've got most of the ball-based jokes in the book, but is that one in there as well?
No, that is not in there. That is very good. You might end up on the front of the book against your will. I might just steal that off you. You've said it. I can quote it.
You obviously had a lot of fun, Richard, coming up with new bits of slang for your testicles.
Yes.
And so which ones have you got? Run me through some of your favourite ones.
Well, I really like, you know, I'd always weirdly compared the testicles to a slightly less wrinkly version of the Chuckle Brothers. And then I've also now arguably lost the funniest one. So it's, it's sort of, that seems a very apt metaphor that's come back to bite me. I kind of liked the kiwi fruit in a hairy shopping bag. I think that was a pretty accurate representation. And comparing them, this is for people of our generation to, well, they're very much the backing singers in the band The Testicles. If you're noticing them, there's something wrong because you've got the charismatic frontman. They're very much the two blokes who stood in the back in East 17 doing that with their hands are the testicles. So I think you know, any, it's kind of fun to think of any. I wrote a book called Talking Cock, obviously. There's lots of, 20 years ago, there's lots of things from my career, because I have been obsessed a little bit with that area, but also Weirdly, other things have come in that sort of feel slightly ironic and like fate has directed me towards losing a testicle. So I had spent a long time coming up with euphemisms for the penis. And I think that was just going into it. There's less for the balls, I have to say. It was a little bit harder for balls. I think in Talking Cock, I tried to never repeat the same descriptive word for penis all the way through the book. I don't think I succeeded. But with balls, I did think, there are only 5 or 6 real main ones if you're not trying to get a laugh. If you could talk about gonads, bollocks, balls, you know, you start running out of the general descriptors quite easily, whereas the penis, it sort of is an endless parade of euphemism. But yeah, it is, you know, that sort of thing is fun, and I think as long as it's in passing and as long as it's not the only joke in the book, I think it is really good fun to. It's that Viz thing, isn't it? It's the Viz Profanosaurus, which I love, the sort of poetry of the gutter when they come up with something so good. And I think always with that area, it was what Talking Cock was about really as well. You know, it's been so covered by comedy over the years. To find anything or a different way of looking at it or any different euphemism for anything down there is a kind of triumph as a writer or a comedian. So I like going into that well-worn area in many ways and then seeing if I can find something new in there.
Yeah, the McSquirter twins.
Yeah, the McSquirter twins is a
because
nice
that's
one.
A good 80s reference as well. So that's nice and niche.
The problem, though, you sort of realise, as the last 20 years have passed so quickly, you do a reference to something. You know, I wanted to... I wanted to reference Roland from Grange Hill in something recently. I just thought, nobody under 50 is going to understand what... 45, maybe. No one's going to understand what you're talking about. I was going to call Roland someone... Maybe it was... I can't remember it. Right, it was Ryland. I was going to talk about Ryland instead of Ryland. I just thought, one's going to get it.
That phrase was one of the ones that I just used to use more or less every day. Why are you so fat, Roland? And I think that's what she... There was a character in Grange Hill who actually said that to this character who was large and played by an actor called, I think, Erkan Mustafa.
That is correct.
And she would say to him... She was trying to be nice to him. She was trying to be one of his allies. And she would say things like, why are you so fat, Roland? So the book... is about your brave battle with cancer, and I'm not obviously saying that ironically, but I'm using the prescribed cancer parlance, which I do believe is now gradually being discredited. I hear from more and more people who get cancer that they don't really appreciate having the whole thing characterized as a battle.
No, and it isn't a battle, and in fact, if it is a battle, it's one that you're entirely passive in, because it's a battle for the medical professionals who save your life or who sort it out. But really, once you've got, I don't know the experience of any other cancer, obviously, but with testicular cancer, it's very much I lay back and let someone cut out my testicle and let someone else give me chemotherapy. And so, you know, there was nothing that I did that helped me get through this, apart from, I suppose, having a positive outlook and seeing the funny side of it. But I don't think that, I think that was a way to cope rather than a way to defeat cancer. I think the problem with it as a battle is that some people get through it and some people don't. And so it implies that you're at fault if you fall victim to cancer, if you die from cancer, that is somehow your fault, which obviously is not the case. So I think it's a weird thing to happen, and I still find it very hard to process the fact that I've had cancer. And you know, I still don't. Throughout this book, I'm sort of constantly saying, yeah, it's not real cancer, because it's easily treatable, and compared to other cancers, it doesn't feel as extreme, but you know, it is. That's what I have to keep on trying to remind myself, is that I actually have had cancer, I'm very grateful to everyone who got me through it, but I can't really take any credit for it.
Well, I suppose the battle metaphor is useful to the extent that a positive attitude to the whole thing and a good sense of humor is a useful weapon when you're in that situation or any stressful situation. It is, and it definitely can make a difference to not give in to a feeling of total despair.
Yeah,
you know,
I think it gives you power over something that you're sort of powerless against, I suppose. So it gives you a sensation of power over it, and to not take it seriously. And you know, because there's no point. I mean, you know, if you want to take it seriously, fine. I'm not saying everyone has to go through this in the same way. If you want to be very morbid and serious about it, that's fine. And I was morbid about it as well. But, you know, it just feels like that has to be the response that I think sort of it's not in any sense bravery. It's just, you know, this is happening and let's see. I mean, that's what this book is, really. It's sort of amongst the dark thoughts and the horrible thoughts. It's like all the funny, you know, when you stop to look at all the funny stuff that's happening around you. And it's as a comedian, as I say in the book, it's sort of, you know, it's the kind of thing you almost dream will happen to you. Because you think, what would I do if I went blind or if I lost all my legs or, you know, whatever. And so having ball cancer as a comedian feels, you know, I talk about it as landing in my lap, which is, you know, is very much true. that it's the funniest place that is possible as a comedian to get cancer. And as I say, for me personally, having concentrated on masculinity, genitalia, even like Hitler moustache, living as Hitler for a year and then ending up with just one ball as well. You know, it feels like I did a short film about 10 years ago where my character had cut off all his genitals and sort of over the weekend while his wife was away. So all these things just seem to be feeding into who would be the funniest person we could give this to. But it also feels a little bit like who would be able to, you know, be able to use this information to like spread a bit of information about it and spread a bit of laughter about it, and also hopefully help other people as well. I think I mean, I was very positive about it, and apart from very early on when I was scared of, I just thought about leaving my kids behind, which was something we all fear as parents anyway. I felt reasonably positive about it, but it also made me, you know, focus on what was important in life. So I think it was very good for me in lots and lots of ways to have this moment, and also to be, not that I stopped completely because I was podcasting all the way through this, but to have time to just sort of stop and think as well, which I think all of us in our lives, especially when we're so busy, we're just zooming on and suddenly 10 years has gone by and we haven't really thought about ourselves or self-care. And, you know, we're older men now and, you know, it's not ridiculous, the idea of a man in his early to mid-50s, you know, pegging out. And it's quite good to prepare yourself for that and remember and try and stop it happening as well. So, you know, actively kind of realise your own mortality properly. And I've always thought about death and always been obsessed with death. But in that moment when I got that weird phone call from the GP, who'd been very upbeat when I'd been seeing him and said it was almost certainly not anything to worry about. And then hearing the shake in his voice as he obviously realised it almost certainly was cancer and he wasn't able to say so. You know, that was the moment that it was really like, oh, fuck, you know, I felt like I was going to be dead in 2 weeks at that point, you know.
Yeah. And he said, wow, it's really big. When he was looking at the scan, is that true?
I'm not sure to what extent I do remember him talking about the size of it. I'm not sure he said that exactly, but that was certainly the gist of what was going on. He was like surprised by it. You know, he'd felt it. He'd felt my balls very quickly. I just met him and he felt my balls, and he was very, very confident that it wasn't cancer. And that he knew what it was. And he was quite a new GP. And I genuinely think he was just, and he's not in the practice anymore. He was actually a fantastic GP and everyone misses him in the village. And he kind of fell out with the people running the surgery and thing and moved on. And it's a real shame because he was excellent. But I think from his point of view, it might be, oh no, I told this man he hasn't got cancer and he has probably got cancer. But you know, equally that would have been an issue if he'd just gone, no, it's not cancer, fuck off. go and then 2 years later, the amazing, you know, the thing about this is if you spot this cancer early enough, then it's so treatable and it has an incredible survival rate. And I think it's really, some of them are a much more aggressive type of cancer, so it's not entirely true. But it's the people who leave it and think, oh, it's probably nothing, and then it's spread a bit, and then you can get into trouble. So it does kill people, and it does affect people's lives in a bad way. So just the fact that I was, during those COVID times, got into hospital within days, and sort of, you know, and had, it was a month between going into the GP and having the testicle removed, which is incredibly fast when you think about it, about all the things you have to do, and during a lockdown when there was other things to worry about. So, you know, I'm nothing but grateful to that guy, but it was a hairy moment. But again, I think I'm glad they didn't tell me straight. You know, I'm annoyed they didn't tell me straight away that the survival rates were so good. But also, I think it did those weeks of thinking that, you know, that it might be that serious, that it might be, you know, I might have to put my life in order. I think it was good to have that, mm-hmm. and it was interesting to think about my relationship with my kids and how they would remember me, and try and create situations where they would remember me that kind of went wrong. Like when there's a chapter about me, it's snowing and me thinking, brilliant, this is perfect. Then my daughter, I remember all the times it snowed. My daughter will definitely remember this. My son might remember this. And we tried to make a snowman and there was just cat shit all over the garden. So we just made this horrific cat shit cover, and then some dog diarrhea. And it was just this awful, you know, which I'm sure my daughter would remember. Then she made her own snowman, which fell apart and she cried. And it would be an awful memory. And it was, you know, it's just, that's just so funny, you know, in retrospect. We were talking in another podcast about my blog, I think I would have forgotten entirely about that incident had I not blogged it. But then going back to write the book, I went, oh my God, you know, and realizing what was going on in my mind. I remember there being a video, my wife taking a video of my daughter throwing a snowball at me and me sort of laughing. But no, you know, as that was happening, kind of thinking, oh, this could be, the, you know, this could be the video my daughter looks back at, and my face, you know, betrays that, at least to myself, that I'm sort of thinking, oh God, this is, hooray, yes, well done, I'm dead now. Ooh.
That's the problem with having that comedian's mind, though, is that you're constantly analysing all these moments from all different angles, and they take on so much significance. Were you able to stop yourself Googling the condition before you knew more about it?
You know, so that was the weird thing. So I Googled it when it was first happening, and I've really tried to look back through my internet history, which is shrouded with all sorts of terrible things, obviously, to find what I Googled, what I Googled originally, because I Googled it and came away thinking, it's fine. It's not anything. Right. And they do sort of say it's probably nothing to worry about, but go and see your GP. Everything basically says that. And so I don't know how, you know, I was in denial, or I wasn't, you know, I saw what I wanted to saw, or I somehow came across a page written by a maniac that has now disappeared. I don't think I did Google it that much, because I think I would have found out that the prognosis was pretty good. You know, I think I did sort of trust the professionals, and it was a bit of a blur, I have to say. And it was a bit at times, you know, time just stretched. It felt like it felt like ages between each part of it. When I look back at it, you go, that was 5 days. But I remember those, you know, waiting to find out, waiting to go in, having a scan, and then waiting to go in to talk to someone about the scan. And then feeling like, even then, when I knew that it was coming out, it felt like ages. I was waiting just for the phone call to tell me when it was going to be. And I decided that I'd slip between the, because we'd done this, we'd vacillated about whether I was going to store any sperm, and then decided not, we said we would, and then we decided not to. And I thought, oh, maybe I'm still on the list of their wait, you know, and that's why they haven't, and I'm getting the cancer spreading, and I'm going to, you know, so I don't think I was Googling anything. I think I was just letting my own brain kind of be as paranoid and hypochondriac as possible. I don't think I was, because it was only after they it was out and they confirmed that it was cancer, which they couldn't do until it was out, that the guy went, yeah, look, there's two types of testicular cancer, the good kind and the very good kind. You've got the very good kind. Yes, there's a 99% survival rate. You go, wait, what? lead with that. Like, come in, that's as you're going in to get them scanned. If this turns out to be testicular cancer, you've got one. It's still one in, you know, I think it's still like within 5 years, 5% of, you know, 95% of people have survived, which is, you know, it's not insignificant if 5% of people die from it, but it's,
yeah,
but it's, or die within 5 years, it's not necessarily of testicular cancer. But,
and yeah, what was the moment that you knew there was something wrong? I mean, you make the point in the book that you have been proactive and a proponent of more awareness among men,
yeah,
of all sorts of things, physical health, mental health, getting your balls checked, checking your balls regularly. And yet it wasn't something that you yourself necessarily always did.
No, and I don't think I did, you know. So I was, but I was aware of it. I gradually became aware that there was something that didn't feel right. But I can't say that I was going every month and assessing, and, you know, so part of the problem was it felt a bit weird, but I wasn't sure whether that was how it always felt.
Yeah,
because I wasn't, you know. And also that thing of, you know, that I did jokes about, that lots of comedians joke about as you get older, your balls start to, gravity starts to take its effect on your balls and they start to get lower. And so, but I think like a bit of me was thinking, oh, well, that's all that's happening here. When I sat on one of my balls, which I'd never done. I'd done a joke about doing, but it never happened. And I thought, oh, that's so, oh, that's that happening then. So yeah, it was, it's, and even now I find it hard, but it's hard in a different way now because you're sort of so scared of finding something that it can be difficult to look at stuff. And I think that's why I think men would, a lot of men would rather not know, which is obviously insane. And my oncologist said he was impressed, that I had noticed so quickly. Really, I wondered whether it was because it was so big. I thought, oh, maybe this has been going on for years.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you know, that I because I'd got there before it was outside of the testicle, that I, you know, he was impressed that I was in tune enough with myself to notice. But it was, you know, it did become like, hold on. I actually thought both of them were feeling weird.
And what was it? Was it a swelling or a hardness, or what are you looking for then?
It got. I mean, so there's different things, and so mostly I think guys would be looking for a lump or something, you know.
That's what I would think.
And there wasn't a lump. That's again not knowing. And you know, I knew that it was generally a something that occurred to younger people, and I had no history of cancer in my family, and you know, my balls had dropped fine as far as I remembered it from being a kid, and those are the things that are the signals of it. It felt a bit heavy. It felt a bit heavy. It felt a bit too firm, and it just felt like it was getting bigger. But you know, it was so hard because I mean, it's so difficult because you know, as it was going on, I was just convinced it was getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and it can't, you know, like even once I knew it was happening. So it's very easy to fool yourself. But I suppose the lesson is, even if there's anything there that's just making you think, I don't like this, just go and get it checked out, because no one's they're not going to worry about that. And most things. So like as I was writing the book, I got a lump on the other one, and. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, you know, I was absolutely convinced that meant it returned. And if it had returned, that was really bad news in terms of maybe it would be spreading everywhere. And that turned out to just be a cyst, which is what it usually is. So once you talk to men about this, most men will go, oh, yeah, I went in and I had a cyst. And oh, I was worried about this and this happened. So they're not, you know, it was very interesting to see the difference between a scan, some of the person doing the scan, one who finds bad news and good news. And it's obviously a lovely thing to be able to tell someone, don't worry, this is fine, this is nothing to worry about, but no one's going to be cross with you for going and getting checked. So if you it's about getting to, you know, once a month you should be having just a little feel around, just to check there's nothing unusual on there, and just to also just to become familiar with it. And my my oncologist is, you know, is saying like 10% of older men do get it, so it's not just a young man's thing. And I guess as we live longer, that things could go wrong, go wrong as well. So you know, it's such a simple thing, and it's so treatable, and it would be such a shame to have died as a result of just going, oh, you know, I'm too embarrassed to go and talk to this. Mm-hmm. Or I know I went through all of that when I don't want to bother them because it's COVID times and it's just a freaky, weird ball. It'd probably be all right. But
what if I get an erection while they're checking?
All of these things. That would be wonderful if it happened that easily. But yeah, so it's, you know, it's overcoming all of that stuff and not. And, you know, it just eats away at you. And obviously, I found it harder. This year has been harder than last year, just in terms of the paranoia and then going, I can't keep going back in and saying, is this all right? You know, like, weirdly, because things have happened. And I've been right to go in for nearly all of them. I've been in, like, a couple of times. And I think maybe one time it sort of has turned out to be nothing to worry about. But they've all been nothing to worry about. But there was at least a cause for the other two. But, you know, you start to... Once it's happened, I think it is that is then always on your mind, and that's a weird thing to cope with. And there's no real psychological help that's offered anyway for cancer survivors. And you know, you are constantly. I think you become aware that your body can just suddenly decide it wants to self-destruct and take you down with it, and that's a very weird thing to have to cope with. But on the plus side, I'm going in this week, tomorrow, in fact, for my CT scan that I get every year to check. They check everything to just check there's nothing going on. So, you know, it does feel like, for me personally, this has not been a negative experience, because I think I'm trying to be healthier in my life anyway. I get like a regular checkup for 5 years. So if anything else happens, they'll be right on top of it. And it's focused my mind, and obviously as a comedian, it's been, you know, I've got a lot of stuff out of it. So it's, that's not something that can happen for most people, but I think it will, you know, I think there are positives for everyone from stuff like this, I think. And I think, I don't think it's a bad thing to be made to stop and consider. And especially if you can then be made better, then that's,
yeah.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive and June. Olive and June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive and June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive and June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
The other aspect of the book is that you weave in interesting cultural ball history and also a lot of information, general information about how balls work and what they do. Richard, why do we need balls?
I mean, it's a good question, and not all living creatures have them. So they're an amazing thing. And that's, again, researching this and having written a whole book about penises, and I neglected the balls almost entirely.
Everyone does.
And that might be why I'm being punished. My balls might have decided to punish me for concentrating so much on my penis, which is maybe understandable. But yeah, but having looked into it, just, you know, the there is not just obviously sperm production. So we need them for that. The gametes that produce human life, which is a pretty impressive thing to start with, and the quantity that they create is phenomenal.
Is the fluid actually inside the testicle?
No, so the fluid, I think most of the fluid comes from outside of the testicle, but I only realised this, I think I sort of knew it, but yeah, there's, I think the sperm in the testicle and then the something else, which the name of it escapes me at the moment, produces fluid, which then is a river that takes those. I think it must be a bit of fluid with the sperm, otherwise they'd just sort of flop around like trout on the floor.
Yeah.
But also... it produces testosterone, so you know that without that there would be all the male changes in the body wouldn't be there, and also you would be unable to get erections, I think, without assistance of some kind.
And your voice is higher, hence the castrati.
Yes. That's a very weird. So I do write about that. That's a very, you know, you could write a whole book about that. I'm sure many people have, but that was so many weird things have happened throughout history with this, and so many of the stories. I think when I went to look through, obviously the mythology isn't real, but people's ideas about how balls worked and what they did, and stories about Hitler only having one ball. Nearly everything is just absolute bullshit.
Where does the Hitler thing come from?
Well, I think it comes from the song. And so, like, some. Just...
I mean, but yeah, but they, were they just trying to? Were they just? Was it fake news? They were just trying to bring down Hitler with some impugning his ball quotient.
That's a tactic as old as time to kind of emasculate the enemy or make them seem, you know, not as manly, and that's, you know, it's weird that balls are where manliness is supposedly located, because they're the weakest part of your body, so there's overcompensation there, so all these things are weird. But yeah, it's a way, you know, I think that's a way to laugh at your enemy. You go, oh, it's the same as me laughing at my testicular cancer if you're being attacked by Nazis. A way to make that less fearsome and gruesome is to imagine
now,
that
I want to address this ball thing. This is fake news! Fake news! I have two great Nazi balls!
But, there's evidence that both ways that he did and he didn't, and so it has become like a thing. A lot of the evidence that says he's got one ball came about, you know, has been rediscovered recently, that makes it seem quite dodgy. And I think it's very unlikely that he only had one ball. I mean, he had a lot of problems, not least being a Nazi. I think he had a lot of issues and sexual issues. So I think there was stuff going on. But I would say it entirely comes from someone noticing that Goebbels and Nobles will sound the same and working backwards from there. And it's very funny. So the original lyrics that Himmler has something similar is a very funny line. So, you know, it's There's just so much misinformation, and you know the thing about for centuries people believed that, you know, one was the boy testicle and one was the girl testicle, and you would just think that would have been, you know, so nonsensical and so easily disputable.
That one ball is responsible for producing the sperm which will lead to a girl being produced.
Yeah, so a female and male. Yeah, and so they used to tie up one testicle they would produce. Oh. And you would think just doing that for a year or two, go, hold on, this isn't really, you know, it seems to be that it's still fairly random.
Yeah.
So you know, but that, I think that went right, you know, it was a Greek thing, but it went right through to the 18th or 19th century. People were still claiming that. So, you know, I found that with the cock book as well. It was just astonishing, you know, with people didn't realize that, I mean, they got to the stage where they believed women were just the soil in which the homunculus that was in the sperm was planted, and that the women were basically a grow bag and men put the seed in, and women had nothing to do with the baby. And that was right up to the 1900s.
Wait, that's not true.
There's little, your testicles are full of tiny Adam Buxtons, all waiting to. It was really interesting looking at that. And I wanted with this book, you know, it wasn't just I didn't want to just write about my experience. I wanted to invest. Having written this, you know, having written a few books about masculinity, having written this book, The Problem with Men, which was about the International Men's Day, but why men are so insecure about this and how we actually can move forward and create an equal world and stop being such dicks. It sort of was, again, weird to be, I wanted to look at why balls were associated with masculinity and what the truth of all of this stuff was. And like I say, I think the biology of it is, and obviously the balls are outside the body partly to do with temperature, which is what I've always thought. But there are species that have them internally, yeah. and equally, you know, it's not just that. So they're one's lower than the other. I think the temperature might be, and they're not quite sure that if it's outside, the sperm will, when it's in the vaginal tract, when it's in the birth canal, will, or whatever. Terrible. I don't know about female biology. When it's going up to its goal, wherever that is, into the grow bag.
I think it's called the goal.
Yeah, it will notice the temperature change, and so it'd speed up because it realizes its mission's about to be accomplished like a heat-seeking missile. So there's loads of interesting thing in that. And the retraction, you know, they will slightly retract into the body. But you would think that they'd be better protected, right? It seems to make no sense as to... And given they don't even have to be outside the body, why would they be outside the body? And if they are outside the body, why wouldn't they have a nice little bone cocoon, cooling little, filled with little holes that would keep the air coming in? You'd just think they would be better protected. So it's... I mean, there's an argument that it's... like the peacock's feathers, that it's a display to potential mates that you're here. I am. I'm so tough and so amazing that my balls are here on display.
Look at this great wrinkly thing I've got, because there's no real equivalent for a woman. I don't think, you know, it's tempting to think of the breasts as being something similar, but they're not at all, because they're aesthetically beautiful. I suppose you could argue that we consider them aesthetically beautiful because of various quirks of culture and the patriarchy or whatever you want to call it, but I mean, they really look better than balls, even if balls,
I don't think many people would say balls are aesthetically beautiful, even if they quite liked them. I think you would say, I like what they do, I like what they produce, I don't mind licking them, but they're hairy and they're wrinkly. I mean, so, and so are you and me. So, you know, it's a real mystery. I don't think that is true, that they're there as a display, because I think if anything, they potentially laugh at them.
All right, I'm going to ask you a literary question now.
Good.
This from the Book Fox website, from John Matthew Fox, Advice for Writers. And okay. I mean, these are sort of good, serious writer questions.
Good.
Do you think someone could be a writer if they don't feel emotions strongly?
Yes, I think anyone can be a writer. So I think understanding what it is to be human, which, you know, even in negative emotions, even, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean love. It can be, I think you need to be able to communicate effectively, and I think a lot of communication is about emotions. It's not just about words. So if you were literally a robot and couldn't feel emotions, I'm not sure many books would, apart from manuals on how to make things and repair yourself, would be that interesting. So I think it is, it's at least interesting to put emotions in. And I think the people that I like certainly are emotionally honest in terms of what they write, or comedians, you know, talking to you and Pitt yesterday, I just think we're all quite honest men, even when the thing we're admitting to, and often when the thing we're admitting to, doesn't necessarily reflect brilliantly on us. So I think why this book, and it came out very easily, you know, I found it easy to write, and I think it's because I was still caught up in the emotion of it, but also I think it was an emotional journey. A lot of it is actually about family and my relationship with my daughter, especially just because she's a little bit older and a bit more able to understand what's going on, I think. And had a bit more interesting stuff to say at this time because my son was a bit young. So I think the emotion in this book is a very important part of it, because it is that trying to get across that, the feeling that what I felt when I got that phone call, because it was extraordinary what happened to me. And I don't think I've captured it entirely, but...
You had a sort of visceral crying response.
Yeah, but I was just overwhelmed. I was overwhelmed, but not, you know, it quickly turned into this sort of self-pitying thing. But I was sort of overwhelmed by my mortality, and the tears were sort of weird. I have experienced it sort of, but I've experienced when I've been depressed, and there was a, I've talked about this a bit, but I once watched, I was once at home my own watching Love Actually, and I started crying and thought I was never going to be able to stop crying, and it wasn't because of the film. Or not really because of the film. The film triggered something and made me think about how empty my life was, or whatever it was at that time. And I felt I was going to be unable to stop crying. And it was sort of a little bit like that, but not exactly like that. But it, but yeah, to try and get that across, some people might have say, well, I want to keep all these private moments to myself. But I think as a writer, you know, your job is to try and explain all of that. Because I think if you can get that visceral reaction, if you can get that connection... If I was watching Welcome to Wrexham yesterday, which is a wonderful show about Ryan Reynolds taking over.
Oh, yeah, the football thing. Yes, it's good.
But they just had a bit where they just showed loads of fathers and sons, just like cut pictures to loads of fathers and sons just looking at each other and smiling at each other. And it was, you know, it's sort of easy in a way and button pressing in a way, but it was also so beautiful. My son was upstairs and I was just... thinking about my son, and you know, and that's to connect, I think, with people via something human, by something you understand. I think you have to, but even if it's a book full of hate, that's an emotion, right? Even if it's a book full of annoyance, even if you hate humanity, you still have to get that emotion down into whatever you're writing. I think anyone can write anything, and it's up to you what you write, and you don't have to put emotion in it. It can be just a dry description of what's happened. I really encourage people to write, though, you know, especially if you're going through something. I did find it, and I'm not saying I found it an entirely positive experience, because it brought stuff up that I'm still dealing with, but at least it made me realize that I had stuff that I needed to deal with as well.
I think it's
as a comedian, I found it so... I've gone through various depressions in my life and loneliness and, you know, ups and downs, and things go your way and then they don't go your way. And I've always found that being able to express any of it is massively helpful. Equally, loads of the stuff I do is made up nonsense and just stupid, or, you know, the stuff I don't really think or feel. And that's still fun as well, but it's, you know, you do note those bits that people remember, and those bits that really touch people it's often the emotion underneath it, and sometimes it's almost not written, and sometimes it's you feel it coming off the page, don't you? And it's very,
yeah, that's the thing. I think some people, I'm always referring to David Sedaris, because I find him so funny, and yet his attitude to the world and certainly to the way he writes is very different from mine, and he's much more restrained when it comes to writing about feelings. In fact, he doesn't directly do it very much at all,
right?
It's all sort of implied, and in fact you know, he's superficially very harsh when he writes about upsetting things, and a lot of people are kind of recoil, I think, from his books because they find him so cold. But actually, for me, when I read like the stuff that he writes about with his dad, for example, who he had a fractious relationship with, and then his dad died recently, and he just maintains that he always thought his dad was an asshole, but to me it's clear that there's so much more to it than that, obviously.
Yeah,
and there's a real well of powerful emotion in there between the lines, but he never refers to it directly.
Yeah, but you know, it's very hard to distinguish the human experience from any feeling. So yeah, I think writing has to have emotion.
Okay, here's another question from the BookFox website. Do you hide any secrets in your books that only a few people will find?
Ooh,
that's quite a good question, I think, because when I was writing Ramble Book, one of the most amazing books of all time, I think most people would consider it now. There's definitely not secrets exactly, but there's definitely sort of coded stuff there, which I didn't want to, for whatever reason, make overt, but I felt that I had to be honest in a slightly more subtle way.
Okay,
you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. I'm not sure there's a lot. I'm sure there are things, and I'm sure there are little nods, and I'm sure there are jokes that are there for my wife, And I'm sure there are jokes that are in there for, you know, like I almost do that subconsciously now. Certainly like Relativity Again. People will tweet me, go, oh, you put a Shrek in it, you did this, you did that. And, you know, there are these little, you did the 28 years old joke. And, you know, they almost slip in without me knowing, but they're there for the fans. I can't think of anything in this book. Yeah. I mean, there was a few decisions I had to make. There was a bit where I write about my father-in-law, and I'm still not really quite, he drove me back from the chemotherapy and took this really circuitous route to get home, and it really annoyed me. Because I'd said turn left. He said, no, on the way there, he'd gone my way and grudgingly. And on the way back, he wanted to go this other way. And I said, you've got to turn left here. He said, no, I'm going to go my way this time. And it literally took twice as long as the, to get there.
Oh,
and,
no, that's and,
but I think he did it so that he could show me where he grew up, right? Because we ended up going through the village where he grew up. And that's the only way I can make sense of it. But then I never really talked to him about it. And I mentioned it to my wife and her brother, who both agreed with me. And I thought, should I write about this? Because it's sort of a funny thing that happened. And I'm very nice about him because I do think he's a terrific man and I love him. And I still kind of love him for even if he did do this. But I was aware that his wife might give him a... She doesn't know about it. So my mother-in-law might give him a hard time for driving me. I was desperate for the toilet because after chemotherapy, I'd done this, the biggest wee you've ever seen in your life, immediately afterwards. And then immediately the bladder was completely full again. So I had to kind of have this hour and a half journey home where I was desperate for the wee. And I'm worried about getting my drugs in the fridge and all this stuff.
Even if it was a bonding detour, that's the wrong moment.
Yeah, it was the wrong moment, but it's sort of typical of him, really.
Okay, here is one more question from the BookFox website. Well, just generally, how many hours a day do you write? It's kind of a banal question, but it's always interesting, I think, to hear how people actually approach the business of sitting down and trying to write.
I think it is, and that's part something that this podcast really wants to get into grip with as well. I mean, I always write my blog pretty much every day, so if I don't do it every day, then I pick up two on the next day, and that's always sort of 30 minutes to an hour of sitting, either thinking about something or writing something. Sometimes I can knock it off in 15 or 20 minutes, so that's always the first bit of writing that I try to do, unless I'm absolutely bogged down and have to do it later.
And when you're writing that, are you just writing stream of consciousness, or do you sit and revise a sentence and think about a joke or whatever?
It's generally stream of consciousness, and so the difficulties are thinking of something, but as I've got longer into it, because there's sometimes you could sit there for 3 hours not thinking of anything, I've just said, right, if you can't think of anything, you just gotta make a decision. And even if it's just a diary of I took my kids to school and the teacher said hello, and then I went home and didn't talk to anyone for the rest of the day, I'll just get on with it. And then, weirdly, if you do stream of consciousness it and don't go back and revise it too much, stuff crops up and things come out of it. And like some of my better routines have just come out of me really struggling to think of anything and then suddenly sitting down. And then it's with stand-up often, you'll be on stage and just suddenly it all pours out of you and it's brilliant. And sometimes when you're writing, you just go blah, 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 and you look at it and you go, fucking hell, that's amazing. And with the book, I found that sometimes you just sit down. And I found this one much easier than any of the others. I usually get stopped for weeks and on a bit and then don't move on. But it just sort of poured out of me, this one. And it didn't, you know, obviously I revised it, but it didn't need much revising. But with the blog, yeah, if I revise it, it's when I go back and think, can I use this as a stand-up? Or can I use this in a book? I then will obviously then have a think about whether it's the best written it can be. But again, sometimes when you really let your emotions take over and your brain take over and don't think too much about it, what you've written is kind of pure and almost better than anything you're going to do when you consider it. So, you know, I think at its best, what I'm really trying to get into, which I still find really hard, is just write as much as you can and don't worry about the quality of it. And I find that absolutely, and I've got a quote from the guy who wrote The Simpsons, John Schwartz and something.
Schwarzfelder?
So yes, that's it. That's his philosophy, is just get the stuff down, just write as much as you can and don't worry about it, don't worry if it's terrible, and forget that inner critic. And then, you know, I was talking to Rich Dosman at the weekend, he writes 1,000 words a day when he's writing a book and then goes back and revises it, obviously. But if you can do that, you can write 1,000 words a day, you can write a book in 3 months and then spend a month re-editing it and whatever, you know, and obviously go back and think about it. And you'll get ideas as you go. And I prefer, obviously this book is a bit different because it was a story that I knew what the story was, which is why it was easy to write it. But I sort of prefer not to prepare too much and then hope it goes well. But I, you know, in terms of how many hours a day it is, sometimes it's, you know, 20 minutes and I give up and so I have other stuff to do. If I'm actually writing a book, yeah, I mean, if I can do a good solid 2 or 3 hours, I think that's an amazing, absolutely amazing day. I don't think, you know, sometimes when you're on a deadline, you'll write for 14 hours in a day and it's pretty hellish. But if you can get, I just wish that throughout my whole life, I could have written 2 hours every single day. And I just think the amount of stuff I could have produced, you know, because it's, but I think you also do need the burning impetus of a deadline, and you do need, you know, it's obviously easier to write a book if you know it's going to get published and it has to be there for someone. You're aware that people are going to read it, so you want to make sure it's as good as possible. But it's very difficult to, you know, I can't even really remember the process of this. I know the week I got COVID, I got a lot done because it wasn't very bad COVID and I was in a room and I didn't have to do any of the other stuff that I have to do in my life. And then it became a lot easier. I think now I've got kids and a family. If I can grab an hour here or there in the day and sit down and not be disrupted by emails or doing a podcast recording or whatever, then it's pretty amazing.
That's the thing, isn't it? It's trying to clear away disruptions. It's the thing that all writers who've had any success always say is you've got to have a place where you're not going to be disturbed. I mean, I think that it's true that you don't have to write any specific length of time. If you just write something for 10 minutes, then that's better than not writing anything at all. I know people who give up writing journals or diaries because they think they have to write loads.
Yeah.
And they miss a day and then they can't catch up because they think, oh, I've got to write loads and I haven't got time. But that's wrong. You know, you can just put down bullet points or just one sentence, or it doesn't matter really. And if you've got more to say, then great.
And it's so, you know, it's so, I so regret that I kept diaries on and off, and I so regret the time I didn't do it, because the stuff that's there, even if, you know, even in the teenage ones, you know, there's days that are awful or boring, but it's so great to have it. As you get older, you just forget everything. You know, like I look back at a blog from a year ago and can't remember the thing happening. Oh, seriously, I know, I can't have no memory of it. And then the blog might make me go, oh yeah, that happened. And I watch TV shows and completely forget them and can watch them again 2 years later easily and not know what's going to happen. So it's so good to have it. And even if it is a line going, this is the day I did this, that's enough to go, oh God, yeah. And, you know, as I say, if you're writing autobiography, but even if you're, you know, if you're not, for both this and How Not to Grow Up, the blog was just, I mean, for How Not to Grow Up, I only got through it because I was able to copy and paste, you know, a whole load of blog entries and then craft that into the central part of the book. So it's so, you know, you won't regret it. And certainly when I've gone back and done things like Headmaster's Son, you know, having teenage diaries, you know, I just wish I'd got it for all the gaps where I didn't think I'd love to know what was in those gaps and what I was thinking and which girls I was failing to talk to in those months.
You said it. Sometimes I think, like, if you haven't got an account of what you're doing with your days, then it's almost as if you didn't live those days. You know what I mean? I mean, that isn't true. And I don't really believe that. I think, you know, a lot of life takes place in the moment and it has value. Otherwise, you'd be totally desperate on your deathbed. But if someone told you that there was a pill that you could take that really focused your mind and put it in the best condition to write, would you start taking that pill? I think that sometimes, like, because I definitely have days when my brain is foggier than others. And sometimes I feel quite clear-headed and can express myself well. Other days, I just despair. I just think, there's something wrong with me. I can't string a sentence together.
Yeah, I just wonder whether we need those days. I do agree with you. And there were weeks and months. But again, part of the reason I started my blog was because I just felt I was wasting so much time and I was trying to write stuff and failing, and I was really blocked, and I just thought it might help if it might help get me going if I just wrote anything. Mm. But I think, like, if it's going on for a long period of time as a writer, you'd probably try to need to do something about it, and a pill would be very useful. Obviously, I've kind of used caffeine, and I used to use chocolate as a way of kind of just filling my brain with stimulation in the hope that that would work. But I do think there's a lot to be said for the downtime and the thinking time. And often, I've really found this when writing scripts as well, that often, like, I'll sit at a desk for 4 hours and nothing's happening, and then I'll get in the bath and start thinking about something else, and then suddenly the entire plot will jump into my head. I'm not thinking about it, and just suddenly go, bang, this is, you know, like, I remember maybe the second series of Relativity, I was really struggling to think what the arc was going to be of the series, and I was in the bath, and then just suddenly, oh, it's got to be, this character's got to decide whether they're going to keep a baby or not. And then it was just, oh, yeah, and then this, and I wasn't even thinking about it. So I think, because I think so much of it, of writing, is about inspiration, and once you get to a certain point, it's just sort of colouring in, and it's sort of like, okay, we got it now, we can colour it in, and we can perfect and make it a beautiful painting. I wish I could paint. We can make it fantastic. But it's about knowing what's going to happen and phrasing it right enough, I suppose. So I think we do need some of those days off. So I don't think I would take the pill every day, but I wouldn't mind it for some of the days when you really do stuff. But I have found, for me, that around the time I was writing the Talking Cock book, and around that time when I started the blog, I did let deadlines go past, because I got so depressed about where things were going and why no one had really recognized how good all my stuff was. That I kind of thought, what's the point? And I'd made some money, and I kind of thought, what's the point? Now I've got some money, what's the point in even working? But generally, you know, it's not that bad. And, you know, I can't quite remember where I was going with this, but it's, you know, it's...
Keep on keeping on.
Yeah, I mean, you go through difficult times. So I would have liked it then. I think what I was saying, if I could have been forced into writing then, and I regret. I look back and I lost heart too much, and I understand why I did, writing scripts mainly, and I found it too difficult to put my heart and soul into writing scripts that I knew the stupid TV executives were going to say couldn't go on the TV anyway, and so if I put a lot into it and then they said no, that was so painful that I sometimes didn't work. You know, at that point when I think I would have got things on made, if I'd really worked at them, I kind of backed off a little bit suddenly. But I was very good at hitting deadlines, and I'm better again now. But I find a deadline is that pill for me, really, is the deadline will. The humiliation. It's sharper in stand-up because there's actually an audience there, and it's much more embarrassing if you're shit. But for a book, it's harder to gauge. But, you know, well, it's such a privilege, and it's such a wonderful thing, you know, and as much as you kind of look at your Amazon ranking, as I was today, a day before publication, and seeing myself at 74,000 or something, and going, oh, fuck. The idea of, you know, the fact that you've got your book published is most writers' absolute dream. So anything that happens above that, I think, is the cherry on the cake. But if you write a book and you're happy with it, as I really am with this one, and it's someone thinks it's good enough to put in shops and print up, and, you know, some people might read and enjoy, that's got to be your base level of it's gone well. Now let's see what else happens. And the nice thing about this book is that I think it will, between the lines, will save some people's lives. That's just an incredible thing to think that, you know, 1 in 270 men who read this book are going to get testicular cancer at some point. And some of them might have testicular cancer as they're reading it and not realize. And this book might help them realize. It certainly has happened from my tweets and stuff already 2 or 3 times. So it's, you know, that's it's nice to know that there's a mission behind it. Yeah. And it's also nice to think, you know, it would be great, wouldn't it, to sell Richard Osman numbers of books. And
would
have all
it
that
though? And, I don't know. Yeah. That's a whole other conversation.
And have all that money, but it's, you know, I love that we, you know, you and I think are both in a position where we can write a book, and if it does well, lovely. If it doesn't do well, our other stuff is still going to keep our head above water, and so we can, as we do within our podcast work, we can do exactly what we want to do.
And yes, it's
if
a
it,
very...
if it resonates with someone, even if it's one or two people, that's all it needs to be.
Absolutely. It is a very privileged position for which I think we're both very grateful.
Yeah.
And well, that's great, man. And congratulations once again.
Thank you, Dan.
Bollockbuster. Stick it on the cover.
It's a bollockbuster. That's good. That is very nice. And I loved your book as well. People should must read the Ramble book if they haven't already. And you're working on another book next year, possibly?
Well, I mean, I do keep my journal fairly regularly. So I'm hoping that that's going to be a good source of raiding things. But yes, writing about my mum and her last days, trying to make it non-miserable, you know. Yes. I think we both try and talk about those things and keep an eye on making them somewhat funny and putting some jokes in there so it's not just misery lit.
It is, but you know, again, with your one especially, it's something with the, I mean, both my parents are alive, so you know, obviously I'm pretty smug about that, but I understand that that might not be the case forever. So I think, you know, that's an experience that we all have to navigate, really, hopefully, because we would hope that our parents will die before we do. So it's so important that you're writing about those things. It is, and again, it's funny and it's very moving, I think. You know, I love your vulnerability, Adam. It's it's the best thing about you.
Thanks, it's very nice. Much.
But it's not, but the fact that you are, the fact that you'll put it out there, I think it's
well, so it's important. Nice. It's nice that it's characterized as vulnerability rather than needy oversharing.
Well, you know, we wouldn't be doing this if we didn't have needy oversharing. We wouldn't be.
Exactly.
Wouldn't be here.
From one needy oversharer to another, I bid you good luck and farewell.
Thank you very much, Adam.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Thanks for listening. RichardHerring.com/gigs. GoFasterStripe.com for all my books, downloads, all that sort of shizzle. Oh, yeah, I know all the cool words. And would love to see you on the Can I Have My Ball Back tour if you can make it. Bye.